Hello, welcome to Ed and Friends. My name is Ed. I am an improviser from London. And we have another guest in the studio this week. He is a pillar of the improv comedy community here in London. And in fact, he's the man that taught it to me from the off, along with the rest of Giggleloop, of course. He started up Hoopla, which is in itself a cornerstone of London comedy, I would argue. And recently, he's done all sorts of things. He's got YouTube channels. He's been doing a festival, a pre-Edinburgh comedy festival called the Miller Summer Festival. So with no further ado, fresh from his holiday in Greece, Mr. Steve Rowe!
Oh, thank you. Hello, everybody. Thanks, Ed. That was a lovely introduction.
Oh,
thank you for the applause, too. It sounded a lot louder than the number of people in the room.
It's true.
I think it's more about the percentage of people clapping. Like, if you get applause from 100% and the audience is 3, I think that's a better feeling than, you know, 10 people clapping in a room of 1,000. That would be rubbish.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm more about the percentage of audience reaction rather than the total audience gain.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's quite a mathematical approach to.
Yeah, I never thought of it before, but yeah, I think it matters. As you'll see in my YouTube videos, which you mentioned, I've got sketches that have got a whopping 200 views, which is half of them is me clicking refresh to see like how many people have seen this sketch. But they've got 4 likes and no dislikes, and I'm like, that is a win.
Totally.
That's 100% success. That's how I'm not about going viral badly. I'm more about going very small.
Small but perfectly formed, as they say.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, well let's get talk about the backstory a little bit. How did Hoopla get its start?
How did it get started?
Yeah.
As Hoopla started in 2006, it started a bit before that in many ways, because I suppose the origins of it was me and Edgar Fernando, and a few others who we all went to school together. But really bonded through GCSE drama, and I was very lucky enough to go to all the schools I went to did a lot of comedy, which at the time I thought was normal, but now I'm realising is not. That was just a luckily fluke for me. So the middle school I was at, which was when I was about 10, used to put on like summer sketch shows where we'd write and perform sketches, and also put on like Monty Python sketches, Two Ronnies, Morecambe and Wise. So all these things. So that was quite a big thing. And then GCSE drama, we did that together, we loved it. I actually lost confidence in myself completely in terms of being up in front of an audience all the way from like 17 all the way through university. But then after uni, I was back in London working and just looks around and I was like, it's got to be more than this whole work stuff. And then, it just turned out like loads of my friends felt exactly the same time. We're at a very similar period in life. And we were lucky enough to grow up in London. And obviously, so for us, it was never a new scary place. But obviously, lots of people moved to London and looking for new things to do. So we were like, right, let's start up. Let's do a drama club or something. And then it was going to be sketch comedy. And then I happened to be going to improv classes, and I brought that back to it, and everyone was like, oh yeah, this is it. This is what we're going to be doing. So we were doing that, and then Friends of Friends started to come along to the people I knew from old GCSE drama days, and then it kind of took off from there very gradually, very slowly, going back to the theme. It was not a viral success. The origins of it were 3 years doing a free workshop in a room above a pub in Balham for like 8 people.
Nice.
For ages, it was just that. And not that we do know what we're doing now. We definitely didn't know what we were doing then, and also knew that we didn't know what we were doing. And anyone who came, it was also apparent that we didn't know what we were doing either. And but there's something joyfully about the fact that no one in the room knew what they were doing.
Right, right.
Every now and again, someone would turn up who knew a bit more improv. And it put a damper on things, to tell you the truth. Because everyone was like, oh, right.
Oh, great, the professionals in the room.
Yeah, they wouldn't really like it, and then they'd leave. But then, so it was just a bunch of, like, sort of being joyfully unprofessional with it all. And kind of disrespectful of it as well, which I know that sounds like a bad thing to say. But I think it's helpful in... I think it's helpful in an art form to have a healthy disrespect sometimes. So yeah. You don't want to be trapped in a structure of like, oh, this is what you're meant to be doing. And in fact, Roderick Miller was really supportive of us right from the start. He's like an improv legend in London. He's done loads of improv. And he was like, he said what was nice about us at the start is we were just reading some random game in a book on a Monday. And then by Thursday, it was like on stage and we were doing it. And he'd be like, we'd be playing it but no one really told us how to play it, so we were just doing it and finding our own fun with it, which I think is nice. And something, hopefully, we try and encourage, now we're teaching courses and stuff, for people to be like, yeah, you can learn a bit of improv, but I mean, it's in the name, it's called improv, it should be improvised, and you should be like, you know, there is no should. Hopefully find your own fun with it. And if you're not enjoying it, then find a way to enjoy it and pursue what you love about it.
Mm-hmm. I suppose if you're going to do anything new with anything, you've got to break the rules at some point, haven't you?
Yeah, you have to break the rules. Yeah, it's actually a nice creative technique. It's actually called breaking the rules. So what you can do, you can use it in TV sometimes as well. So this is where I got it from. So if you want to create something new, so like create a new improv show, in one column underneath you write down a list of like, what are the rules of an improv show? So it might be like, there's an audience, it's on stage, we get a suggestion, there are actors. The column next to it, you then go through one by one and you write that what that rule is broken. So it would be like, there's no suggestion, there's no audience,
there's no stage,
there's no actors, there's no stage. And then you're like,
nobody applauds.
And you just pick one of them, nobody applauds, yeah. But then you pick one of those things. So you'd be like, maybe like, what if there's no stage? So it's like, oh, okay. So if that was true, then how could we make a show around that? So that makes me think about parks. So I'd be like, right, maybe how would improv work in a park? And already you've gone off in a slightly different direction rather than constantly trying to pursue what other people have done. It gives you a chance to just sort of realise that a lot of the rules we put around ourselves creatively, they're just sort of our own little constructs that we've put there. But actually, there are no rules because it's a creative art form. Like, that's the whole point. And in fact, if you look at the origins of improv, it's just mind... It's such... Can I allowed to swear?
Yeah, swear.
It is such a mindfuck. Right, get this. So the oranges of improv are just... They're incredible. It's like literally reading the history of the 60s. It's like... So Ken Kesey, an author, and who wrote On the Road? Jack Kerouac. These like incredible beat writers, like they were really into like spontaneous prose. And... But at the same time, get this, they ended up on this bus called the Merry Pranksters, which was the bus that went around delivering LSD while it was still legal to various universities around America and basically kickstarted this whole kind of psychedelic 60s movement. Guess who else was on that bus? I know you know. I'm just doing this for the listener. By the way, just so you know, the listener, Ed is like giving me eyes of like, he knows, but he's letting me give the impression that I'm giving him news. But on that bus, Ed, who was it?
I don't know, Steve, tell me.
It was Dale Close. Close then founded like loads of other... Like, basically, a huge amount of modern improv. Well, not all of it, but, like, a huge amount of it. He was on that fucking bus. And now improvisers are worrying, should you or should you not break the rules? Of course you should fucking break the rules. Dale Close was on the Merry Pranksters bus at the same time, pretty much the same time, as Keith Johnston was here, just causing, like, havoc. And, like, he was not, like, now people... I have a lot of respect for Keith Johnston, but I feel like we shouldn't respect him so much that he's telling us what to do, because I have respect for the fact that he had no respect. So yeah, the origins of improv is like hugely like shambolic, chaotic, exciting. I feel like that's our responsibility to keep doing that. Like the same before Dale Close and Keith Johnston and Viola Spolin and David Shepherd, you just have to like push boundaries sometimes. Like Ken Campbell was a great British figurehead for that.
Let's quickly just explain who specifically Dale Close and Keith Johnston were.
Yep.
So Dale Close, during following his time in the Merry Pranksters, he set up the Improv Olympic in Chicago.
Yeah, so he was in, I think it was a bit of that, a few different places before, but he definitely ended up in Chicago.
Mm.
And Chicago's become a bit of an improv capital of the world.
Totally. And Keith Johnston developed a similar but parallel practice in London, yep, and then in Montreal, right?
That's right, yeah. So Keith Johnston started, he's English, he started in London. He was a teacher, got a bit disillusioned with it all, and ended up play reading at the Royal Court Theatre in London. Yeah, he was trying to encourage kind of better creativity in writers originally, and he found people tend to just sort of sit around and talk intellectually, so he's trying to cut through that and just get people up on their feet. But then that led to him discovering a form of improvisation. Post-war, mass TV was taking off, so people were spending a lot more time watching screens and disconnecting from each other. So then if you have improv that comes along, it kind of in a way, people have to be almost enabled to do what they used to do quite naturally. We would have always been in human contact with each other. It'd been hard to avoid it. But these days, you have to actually make an effort to be in human contact with someone, I think.
That's really interesting. I've never quite thought of it that way. The idea that an audience was suddenly made passive by the 60s or the post-war era with television and all the rest, and then improv was a way of giving them agency again.
Yeah, it's one of many ways. It's a big driving force for me. I grew up in South London. I was born in Tooting, and sort of my family are from Tooting and Wandsworth. And it was really interesting to hear the stories of how that area used to be compared to what it is now. And it's quite sad, really, because back in the day, there were so many music halls, like all across London. It's just unbelievable. Like there's something like most weekend nights, something like a third of the London population or more would be in a music hall or theatre. That's how popular they were. And so for my grandmother's generation, after work, you just went to music halls, you went to ballroom dancing. There was like my granddad was a pub singer. Like he was an accountant by day, pub singer by night, which I can totally relate to. I never knew him, unfortunately. He died before I was born.
Oh.
But when I was growing up, I just sounded like an interesting character because I was like, so now I'm like improv teacher by evening. And so he was like accountant by day, pub singer. My dad said he wasn't even a good singer, but he was sort of comically bad, but like really enthusiastic. And that's what works in a pub. And so, yeah, so Tooting and like the Beatles used to play there and the Rolling Stones, Jimi Hendrix all played in Tooting. And then my dad said that before TV took off, before that it was the movies. And even then they were a lot more sociable. So you had like almost every stop of the Northern Line used to have a cinema, not just a cinema, but I think Tooting had like three or something. And they were massive. And you had Saturday morning pictures where like my dad said, not just... You went every Saturday and all kids went and it was like the cartoons and then the films and more cartoons and you paid one ticket and then you're in there the whole day. And he said it was complete chaos. Kids used to shout and scream all the way through everything and like popcorn everywhere. But it was like really sociable. And he remembers when TV came in that there's definitely suddenly people, and obviously more cars arriving as well, people off the streets, and then London stopped being such a sociable place. It used to be a lot more community driven than it is now. I mean, I know I'm probably romanticising it, but I think there's nothing wrong with that because if you can take something from it. So, it's a big driving force for Hooplo. It's not just the improv, but it's also about trying to make London a sociable place, try and connect people together and try and get a community, really.
Totally.
And improv is one of many things that are trying to do that, I think.
Yeah, it strikes me that the improv generally is very much a community. I mean, there have been lots of jokes made by past, present, by people greater and lesser than ourselves that improv has many cultish qualities. But it feels like you can definitely, and this isn't me blowing smoke up your ass, you can definitely tell.
He says just after saying it's cultish qualities, he's just turned me into a guru that you can't smoke up enough.
But it's funny that you can you can spot a Hoopla improviser, I think.
Can you?
I think so.
And there's is it the burn marks?
It's the brand.
Because they have to go through that to get.
it's the weird tribal tattoos and the emphasis on chanting before each scene. Honestly, I think it's a certain community spirit. It's a degree to which they are supportive and to a degree to which that they are confident and sometimes even impulsive. The way that there's a certain courage in Hoopla performers, I think.
Yeah.
Because...
I'm glad you said impulsive. That's my top of my list at the moment.
Is it?
In improv, yeah.
Okay. Are you yourself trying to be more impulsive? Are you trying to teach people to be impulsive?
I don't think you can teach someone to be impulsive. I think you can just let them... and like encourage them, because to non-improvisers that looks super weird from the outside. Like I've had people get outraged. They're like, how can you teach improv? How can you teach improvisation? And when from first said that to me, I was like, oh, well, there's loads of stuff. But then actually now I'm like, actually they have got a point, because what's nice about that question, like the outrage question, is that they've captured like the core beauty of improvisation is that it should be improvised. And I think in improv, we got to be careful that we don't give ourselves so much other stuff to do that we're accidentally doing that instead of the actual beauty of not knowing what you're doing. And raw spontaneity doesn't have to mean like shouting and screaming and swearing. It's just, it can be just that beautiful moment of not being completely fucking lost, but still being there. Like, that's really exciting for me. It's just like when people feel confident and brave enough to be like bravely and vulnerably lost in public for a second, I suppose. It's just like, it's almost like having, I never thought of this before. It's like having just, you know, all these little things where we muck up in real life.
Yeah.
And we hide them away. But on stage, it's like, it's very vulnerable, but nice to just allow ourselves to still be in that vulnerable place, not being all brave and being like, there's nothing wrong here. But just when we muck up, just allow the audience to also still see that. That's quite funny for me. So I was at the water stains on the way here because I needed the loo, because I was new to your house. I didn't want the first thing. I hate to be someone's house. You know, you go to someone's house for the first time, you can't be then be the, you can't walk in the door and be like, oh, I need your loo. If it's like the fifth time, you can do that. Sure. But I was like, I'm not going to wee in Ed's house the second I get here. So I went to the water stains.
And you could, by the way, you could have done if you wanted to.
Huh?
I'm going to say this now, you could have done.
Oh, yeah. I know. I'm not saying you wouldn't have said no. No, you can't. But I thought I wanted to, you know, come in professional.
Fair enough.
Anyway, so I went to this water stains and there was one loo in the basement, and there was this lovely Spanish couple. They didn't speak any English, and they were like, first I accidentally walked in front of them. I thought they were looking at books, but they were looking at books while waiting for the loo. So I walked in front of them as if to go to the loo. The Spanish lady just went, hola, and then pointed to the loo and went, gracias. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. And then, so then I had to queue for her, and then queue for her husband. But then when he came out, he looked traumatised. He looked absolutely traumatised because I was there. And he had been a while, he looked traumatised, and he goes, problem, not, and he's like, that's not a fake, I'm not doing a Spanish accent, he goes, problem, gracias, hola, not my fault, and then left, and then pointed to the floor, and the loo was just like, completely overflowing with like water all over the floor, there's only one loo in there, and then he dashed off. And I was like, it's okay, gracias, no problem. And I was like, right, I need a pee. But he's left this like DSLR, really expensive camera and tripod in there. He's hurried off.
No.
So then I had to go in there and I went, all I did is across the water stains, I shouted, hola, like this. He turned around and I just went across the water stains. I went, clicky, clicky. Why doing the mime of a camera? And he went, oh. And he ran back and he goes, gracias, gracias, gracias. And then he takes his really expensive camera, looks at the toilet again, which is a complete mess. Again goes, not my fault. And then runs off. Anyway, so that was a little story. But my point being, it's like in real life, it wasn't that funny. It was just like a kind of normal thing to happen.
A slightly awkward.
There's mainly little moments. But when I was thinking about it, I was like, oh my God, because the beauty of stage is that the audience are sat in a safe place watching you go through all the kind of minor little tribulations and trials and tribulations that you go through in normal life. They get to watch that. So, and that's going back to what the original question about the impulsiveness of it is, that's why I feel like it's more important for me to kind of encourage that, especially with beginners, which is the main people we teach, is otherwise they accidentally cover all that stuff up because they're trying to do something else.
So you've been building Hoopla for 10 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Was it ever a group in and of itself, or has it always been about teaching?
Yeah, it's had different stages, actually. So the first origin of it was, it was just a free drop-in workshop. I would say not really workshop, more like a play session every Thursday in Balham for a couple of years. And like lots of different people would just try out stuff. So it's more like a kind of, I'd say like a practice group, because we were going off to places like the Crunchy Frog Collective, which was run by Alan Marriott and also Dylan Emery. And then we were going to Brighton for the May Days with Katie Shute was teaching there and John Creamer. And so we tend to go to those two places. Oh, and also Sprout Ideas, and then come back and like just practice. And then after about a year of that, we started performing as a group as well. So some people from that workshop would then practice an additional Monday night. And then we put on shows once a month. And it's when the improv scene was small enough that I had just a spreadsheet of pretty much like all improvisers in London. And I don't know why we were like this, but rather than kind of have a set cast, we were like, we want to try and get everyone involved at some point. So a year of that was really awesome. That was every Tuesday night. And then we'd all go out clubbing afterwards and get wildly drunk, and people started like, I mean, it was just, I don't know, it was something quite destructive about it in a nice way. It was like, definitely for me, I was definitely destroying this old past life that I used to have by running out of work early on a Tuesday to go and run this night, and then turning up with after no sleep and totally hungover on Wednesday. I definitely felt like the night was more important than the rest of my life, and it was a bit, anyway, but it was fun. And it was, there was a really nice group of people popped up from that. It brings a tear to my eye thinking about it, actually. It's just, I don't know, we're just all the same age, and we're all quite new to living and working in London properly, so it's that sort of group. And in London at the time, there was a habit of improv groups to just perform by themselves for like the whole night from 8 till 10 with an interval. And they tended to perform like on the same nights as each other. And there was a very small improv audience, which was then getting split between like four nights. And so, as I know, I think we were one of the first people to just be like, why don't we just have a night and get lots of groups performing? We can share the audience, make it a lot bigger. So when I came back from that Edinburgh, we were like, right, let's do it as a club. So that became called Hoopla.
Okay, so Hoopla is now a brand with many, many strands to it, many arms to it, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You've got a YouTube channel full of sketches?
I wouldn't say full of them, but that's very early stages.
Yeah.
We have got a YouTube channel, it's just called Hoopla and Pro. So we've got about five sketches up there at the moment, and there's like about six how-to videos.
Nice.
So, yeah, I'd love to do more of that. If I had unlimited finances and time, that would definitely be something I'd do more of. It's, like, more filming, because I really enjoy it. And but then we're going to make, like, some improv how-to videos with this animator. So it would just be us. I want to kind of document my favourite improv games and, like, just so that if someone was, like, in nowhere near an improv theatre but wanted to start a group, they could just go and look and just be like, oh, cool, I'll try that game. It's really clear. And just give it a try.
See, that's the thing. I was thinking back a little bit about like whether or not I would have been able to do improv if my life had taken a slightly different path. I was thinking about my old school days and doing things like, yeah, like you say, like, you know, being a part of a drama class and doing sketches and doing that sort of thing. But I was thinking that the one school I went to in particular, I might have struggled to have actually, because I loved Whose Lines Anyway when I was like however old I was and it was on TV. But I never would have had the courage to have gone to that community of people and been like, oh, let's put on an improv show. And partly because I don't think there would have been a way for me to have actually learned. I think I would have just been aping something off the television.
Yeah.
And I would have been worried to have been seen to have been aping something off the television. But in the age of YouTube, I guess you can do a sort of an online course in a way, kind of, can't you? You can sort of, I was reading about, there's an Olympic javelin player.
Yeah, I saw that recently.
Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it? It's great.
It's amazing. He learned how to throw javelins at the Olympics through YouTube tutorials. And isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
So I guess Hoopla's the one to do that then.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything wrong with aping as a start, as you say, or like copying as a starting point.
Mm.
But then you can like discover your own little twist on things as you go.
Totally.
We're about to do loads of work with teenagers, actually. It's another new thing we're doing. But sometimes I think it's just about setting the environment or the permission of like, this is, I call it like, this is the new normal. If you tell people this is normal, then everyone's like, yeah, this is fine. Like, so it's the same with it being an improv teacher. If you're kind of all nervous about introducing a game, then people will also get nervous because they're like, oh God, this could go wrong. This is like an unusual thing. But if you just start your class being like, right, hi everyone, we're going to start. Let's get everyone up in a circle. And, you know, just as if you've done it. So this is a totally normal thing to do, to be like basically pretending to be an amoeba while someone else is walking around as a rhinoceros. If one person in the room thinks it's normal, then everyone else tends to.
Oh, that sounds really cool.
Yeah.
I would have loved that as a teenager.
Yeah.
As we mentioned before, one of the new things you've been doing with Hoopla is was the Miller Summer Comedy Festival.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
So that was both us and the Miller. So basically, it's
the Miller is the venue that it happened.
Yeah, the Miller's a pub in London Bridge, and we run our improv nights there. But it's managed by a great guy called James Payne. The way it works is I was booking the improv bits, and he was booking the stand-up bits. I've often thought there was a gap for festivals in July, because there's like the Brighton Fringe in May, and then there's the Edinburgh and Camden Fringe in August. But there's a bit of a gap between June and July, and like, especially late July, most people's Edinburgh shows are ready, so I feel like there's a bit of a opportunity there. And also the acts were really good, so like we're very privileged to be connected to like lots of great acts, and all the improv creeps, they always like promote the stuff there, and they bring in an audience and things.
Going back to Hoopla generally.
Yeah.
What's your favourite thing about Hoopla? In terms of like why you do it?
So Hoopla is the freedom to like make a difference and try out stuff in the world. Improv, it's the freedom to kind of say things, I think, because I quite often, in real life, I mean, you're different because I know you guys, but like, yeah, in real life, I used to find it really difficult, just like, you know, being at a wedding, for instance, quite difficult to know what to say. And like, I mean, the whole of my 20s was in jobs where I was just like, I was doing one thing, but then felt a completely different emotion welling up and just wanted to scream out like, fucking whatever. I think we all feel this in work, right? You just want to, there's stuff that you want to say that you can't.
So you want this cathartic scream of just, you know,
yeah,
fuck you all.
Yeah, like this almost, yeah, like this teenage, in my inner teenager wants to come out all the time. And then in improv, you just, when second I did it, I was like, this is fucking amazing. You get to say what you genuinely think about the world. And no matter what it is, you find that actually it's not only is it not bad, but actually most people can tend to feel similar things to each other. Quite often that's a big improv laugh, I think. It's the improv laugh of connection and empathy. So, and recognition from the audience, where you're getting to say, I think in improv, as an actor, you get to say things that people think but don't get to say in life.
You say that you've been on holiday. Hoopla's got a break in August, basically. When are you guys back?
So we're back the first week of September.
Okay.
The first proper week, around the 4th of September, I think our first workshop starts. And then kicking off, actually, got a big opening weekend at the Miller. Got RH and Friends on the Friday the 9th of September. And Saturday 10th of September, we got a massive free Hoopla party because it's our 10-year anniversary.
Oh, wow.
So we have a big 10-year birthday, which I'm about to announce this week.
Okay.
Should be good.
Exciting.
So I booked in a Rocky-Oki band.
Wow!
So people can come up and they get to sing, but with a full rock band behind them.
Oh, that's so awesome.
And they get to dress up as a rock star and properly milk it. So we're doing that. And then also Edgar's going to be doing like Be Your Own DJ. So he's bringing his decks. And then everyone can have like 5 minutes, but he trains them a little bit on like DJing before they go up.
Oh wow!
And then they're DJing in front of the whole crowd.
Holy shit!
Also dressed up as a DJ.
Awesome.
And then I think the weekend afterwards we've got Paul Merton on and Neil Ashdown and loads of people.
Amazing.
So it's like September's all happening.
Cool. And where can our listeners find out about Hoopla Impro and these dates?
At the website's best, hooplaimpro.com, or Facebook Hoopla Impro, or Twitter Hoopla Impro.
Awesome. What about if people want to learn to do improv? Where can they find out about that?
Yes, we've got lots of beginners improv courses, and they're all starting throughout September and October. And they're all based in central London, London Bridge and King's Cross. And they're also at the website hooplaimpro.com.
I cannot recommend it enough. The very first beginner's class I took was full of people who'd never done it before. You know, everyone from actors to lawyers to accountants to people wanting to just learn how to be more confident to people who want to be the next Amy Poehler. And it was the most fun in the world. It was one of the most, and also just such an incredible bunch of people. When you get a nice bunch of people that just want to play together, it's the most incredible thing. Anyway, thank you very much for being on the show. Thank you so much for teaching me how to do improv, bro.
Oh, thank you.
But before you go,
yep,
we like to play a fun little game.
Okay.
With our guests before they leave. Yes, we decided to bring out an old game from Mothballs. We played this game with Lee Stapleton, the YouTube gamer, the elevator pitch.
Okay.
So the way this game works is that Steve and I are going to feed each other titles of movies that don't exist. And then we will have 30 seconds to describe the synopsis of this movie. Everyone following the rules?
Yeah.
Cool. I'll go first. The title of your movie is Stick It to the Man.
Yeah, so this is a story. Yeah, this is a story about a kid who works in a cab agency. He's a receptionist in a cab agency in downtown Balham. And he's there every Friday night. And every Friday night, this investment banker gets off and he's like, hey, kid, take me back to my apartment or I'm gonna bust your ass. And one day, this kid gets this stick that he's taken from Tooting Common and he shoves it up his nose and he drags him into Tooting Common and slaughters him to death. moves into his apartment and takes it over his job. Stick it to the man. Rated 12.
Okay, cool. That was 40 seconds, but I think I left it longer because it sounded good.
All right.
Cool, we'll make it 40 seconds.
Yours is called The Front of a Pantomime Horse.
Okay, this is the story of a double act gone wrong. This is the story of, what are they called? Jerry Lewis and I want to say Ricky Martin. Dean Martin. This is the story of Jerry Lewis and Ricky Martin in a pantomime horse. Jerry Lewis is randomly disappears and Ricky Martin is left on stage as half of a pantomime horse. And then the mob turn up and there's a damsel in distress and there's a femme fatale and he has to decide between the good and the bad, the sordid and the innocent, and in order to get out of this bind. But he's also got a pantomime to perform at 6 o'clock. the title of your movie is Cats in Production.
Cats in Production. Okay, Cats in Production. Right, so this is a story about it. It's a musical, okay? It's a musical, all right? And so Broadway, they're trying to do the musical of Cats, but all the actors have got a disease, yeah? They all got a disease. They all got like an eating disease. They all got puking up, but they can't make it. And so the producer says, like, what are we going to do? So he goes down the gate. He's like, what is he going to do? There he sees some fucking real cats. He sees some real New York cats. So what he does is he rounds them up. Have you ever tried herding cats? This guy actually herded cats onto the stage, gave them music, and those cats sang like you would not believe, and there was a standing ovation, and then they kept cats in for the rest. Coming soon, dogs.
Oh, that was amazing. I love the fact that you're becoming this like New York film exec, or like this New York musical.
That's my trick. I imagined myself as that character. All right. Right, so your one is called Gaffer Tape Death Squad. Starts now.
The Gaffer Tape Death Squad is loosely based on the Dexter series of books and TV show, but it's actually about it's an expendable style team. So it's all your favourite and most scary horror movie villains. It's got Freddy Krueger. It's got Michael Myers. It's got Jigsaw. It's got all of them. It's got it's got the Jason Voorhees. Like it's the lot of them going on a mission to kill as many people as possible. But then there's tensions between all of them and they end up killing each other. Because they're baddies.
Did you say because they're baddies?
Yeah.
Some films they do that, don't they? They just say, he's a baddie. Don't have to know why.
Oh, wow, that was fantastic. If you'd like to listen to more episodes of Ed and Friends, you can find them at podcastadventures.com. You can also find them at iTunes and SoundCloud and Acast, don't know what happened there.
Acast.
Where you can find past episodes of that as well. Sketch Please is also coming back. You can find more episodes on those same platforms. And thank you so much for listening. And thank you so much to Steve for being part of this particular episode. We will be back next week. Until then, I've been Ed. These have been my friends. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Woo-hoo.